Hi, this is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, and you're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This episode has been edited for clarity and brevity. Happy listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Title IX is 45 years old this week. When you hear Title IX, your mind might initially go to women's sports, and the landmark legislation did level the playing field for public school athletics. But it did far more than that. The aim of the act was to prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex in any federally funded education program or activity. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to look at how things have changed since 1972 with two local experts. Felicia Kornblue is Associate Professor of History and Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at UVM. She was Director of the University's Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies Program from 2009 to 2015. Professor Kornblue, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me.
Renee Berglund is a Visiting Professor of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at Dartmouth College. In her regular life, she's a professor at Simmons College in Boston, and she is the author of Maria Mitchell and the Sexing of Science. Professor Berglund, what a pleasure to have you on the show as well.
My pleasure.
So, in fact, sports was actually kind of far from the top of mind concern when Title IX was passed in 1972. The aim was to prevent sex discrimination. Professor Kornblue, what other kinds of discrimination were people actually thinking about in 1972 as it applied to Title IX?
Well, they were thinking about everything having to do with education, and I think it might be hard for us to think back to that time. The degree of sex discrimination, gender discrimination that people countenanced. One of the chief sponsors of the bill was Representative Patsy Takamoto Mink from Hawaii, the first woman of color ever to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives. And her daughter, who's a colleague of mine, Gwendolyn Mink, was denied admission to Stanford University, even though they acknowledged that she was completely qualified because they said they had reached the female quota and therefore she could not be admitted. And that was 1970, just prior to the passage of this law. So that was the kind of overt sex and gender discrimination that people were facing in admissions and access to resources while in school at every level for faculty. Access to decent jobs, tenure track and tenured positions, decent lab space for women scientists, for women staff at colleges and universities who are still very much underpaid and overwhelmingly female. So really it was about taking on that whole set of institutions and the whole set of ways that sex and gender discrimination showed up in them.
Professor Berglund, was there an incident that prompted the passage of Title IX, or was it just this sort of overwhelming accumulation of slights that led to it?
Well, I think it was probably a revision of the Civil Rights Act, which had not mentioned sex and gender. So the mood in the late 60s and early 70s was about all kinds of civil rights, but sex and gender were a little bit late to the table in some ways.
So, Professor Berglund, what were the immediate changes that schools and institutions encountered starting on June 23rd of 1972?
Well, it was a bit of a surprise, I think, that sports became so central in the early years of Title IX, but it certainly did. And the changes in women's athletics, partly prompted by the overwhelming amount of scholarships that boys had been getting for sports scholarships, turned out to have just completely culture-altering effects for everybody as women were encouraged on – and women and girls were encouraged onto the playing fields in schools and universities. So that was the first big effect. And then after athletics, I think the next real area of focus was probably science and technology and engineering. STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math were the next thing that people got really – concerned about addressing inequities. And finally, more recently, Title IX has had a big effect in addressing sexual harassment and bullying and sexual violence.
Well, partly because schools are required to report on that now. Colleges and universities, at least, are required to annually report incidences of sexual assault. And that's been controversial in looking at how schools are doing that and if they are actually following the guidelines, not just to the letter of the law, but to the spirit of the law, and actually looking at sexual assaults. But that is part of Title IX, is that requirement of reporting. Professor Kornbluh, would you add anything else? Anything else you see as sort of the immediate effects of Title IX and how it's evolved over the years?
Well, I think the early history of it is really interesting, because you see there's a pushback by elite universities saying that they could not equalize admissions on the basis of sex or gender, that that would ruin schools like Harvard if they had to admit women on an equal basis. And so that they actually had a carve out in the original law that they didn't have to equalize. And you also see very early on there was a pushback by male-dominated athletics. And probably part of the reason that athletics became the battlefield was because of the intensity of this reaction. Like, no, we can't do this. It'll ruin America. It'll, you know, ruin sports. And in a way, I think advocates and activists discovered how important that was as a place to advance because of the intense pushback. So that's part of the early history. And I think more recently, we also have to remember that it was Title IX and modern interpretations of Title IX that caused the Obama administration to send out that directive to K-12 schools about transgender and other gender students being able to find appropriate facilities, restrooms and locker rooms and other facilities, and to be treated in a non-discriminatory way. And so Title IX has actually done a lot of work, and that we should remember the Obama administration kind of codified what it was becoming the consensus understanding, or the at least widely held understanding and judicial interpretation of the law. But they did move the ball forward by sending that directive to K-12 schools. And now people who are LGBTQA activists are very, very concerned about what's happening and what might happen in the future.
Because Donald Trump, as president, has actually said, that letter by President Obama, we're not really following that. That's not how we interpret the law anymore.
Exactly. So there is a federal court case that, as I understand it, the Supreme Court has sent back down to a lower level federal appellate court to actually do an interpretation of the statute itself, the original Title IX statute, as opposed to doing an interpretation of the Obama administration's administrative regulations. And that that's going to be coming along, and it might help those kids and the schools that are trying to support them. But there's a great deal of concern.
You know, it's interesting. If you look at the actual text of Title IX, I can read it. It's just one sentence. It says, "No person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance." And, you know, it's interesting, Professor Berglund, because in 1972, I mean, there were different interpretations, but I think generally it was largely assumed that sex and gender were the same thing. And our ideas about gender have been evolving since then. Professor Kornbluh was just saying we've been interpreting the law to relate to gender and sex. How has that been evolving as Title IX has been interpreted, you know, in, up to and through the Obama administration? Has it been thought of as something that relates to gender as much as sex?
Oh, certainly. And these terms are constantly evolving and changing, and people's ideas about what is sex. Oftentimes people think of sex as the biological or physiological body, and gender as more when we're speaking of culture and cultural constructs. But those distinctions don't work so well in 2017, where our ideas about gender, sex, sexuality, sexual orientation are often in a newly sort of fluid understanding. So, for example, with transgender students, the distinctions are different for each person.
I want to talk a little bit about sports, because this is one of the areas where Title IX has been most visible. And part of that is because there are numbers that are really easy to account for when we come to sports teams and the money that's devoted to sports and how that's all defined. And it's also, as you said, Professor Kornbluh, been quite controversial. And I was looking through some of the revisions or attempted revisions to Title IX over the years. A lot of them have come from colleges who have sports teams, and many of them have sports teams that are profitable. And they've been trying to say, you know, if the sport is profitable, then that doesn't have to count for Title IX because we're making money off the sport. We can fund the sport through the money we're making. So let's exempt that. Or, you know, women, I think it was a Brown University case that Brown claimed women are less interested in sports. So all we have to do is prove that, you know, the women who are interested in sports are able to play, but we don't actually have to equalize educational or athletic opportunities. And the Supreme Court said no to that. But it's not like Title IX went into effect in 1972 and said you have to provide equal opportunities for men and women in sports. And that's just been happily followed ever since 1972. Sports especially has been this battlefield. And I'd love it, Professor Kornbluh, if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think it's quite fascinating. Years ago, when I started thinking about this, I thought that the move from Title IX as covering all matters of education, especially higher education, to covering sports was a narrowing or conservatizing move. But I've really come around on that. I think that athletic opportunities should be available to everyone. We should be adequately funding phys ed in every school, K through 12, and making opportunities available in colleges and universities too, and the varsity athletic system. I'm a little skeptical about sometimes in itself. However, given that we have that system, the idea that we wouldn't equalize on the basis of sex and gender just seems bizarre. And I think it hits deep issues about the way people think about who we are as Americans and competitiveness, and the field of athletic battle becomes kind of a microcosm for that. And it's about something we talk a lot about in gender studies, about how we view people's bodies. And typically women's bodies, you know, cisgender, heterosexually identified women's bodies are usually seen on the basis of their appearance, their static appearance. And men, even in advertising and stuff, we see men in action. We see men doing stuff and accomplishing things. Athletics is all about that. It's about using the body to do something, to win, to compete, you know, to get somewhere. And every athletic competition is sort of a story about that. And if we're going to deny the opportunity to women and girls to do that, to have that experience of themselves, and we're going to deny spectators the opportunity to see women and girls doing that, then like, who are we becoming? And, you know, all the issues we worry about eating disorders and about body image disorders that are so prevalent among girls and women in our culture, and that we talk about in gender studies all the time, like access to athletics and to, you know, being coached to develop your body and to work with a team to achieve, you know, things that we can really calculate in terms of performance. Like, it's huge. It's really, really huge. And I'll just throw out a couple of numbers. Before Title IX, 7% of high school athletes were girls. 40 years later, so that's five years ago on the 40th anniversary, 41% were girls. What an enormous difference. 3.2 million American girls and young women were participating in sports and K through 12 education. So that's a law that works. That's a government program that works.
And it kind of defies the argument that girls just aren't interested in sports.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I have heard an argument, I hear this still, that, you know, it's not fair that Title IX requires schools to provide equal opportunity in the terms of equal funding and equal numbers of teams and equal numbers of athletes, because, you know, maybe there are fewer women who want to be in sports, and it seems unfair to penalize the male athletes who, you know, aren't going to be able to have as many opportunities as they might, because a school has to equalize and has to have the same number of teams or the same number of athletes, or devoting equal amounts of money based on their student populations to the female sports. I'm curious, Professor Berglund, what you think of that argument, because, you know, we have seen situations where colleges, for example, had to say, well, we can't have a football team. We've got 57 male athletes, and that's going to just create all kinds of problems under Title IX. So we're going to drop the football program. And it's all because, you know, this stupid law that makes us have to allow women to play sports whether they want to or not.
Oh, I think that's zero-sum game thinking, right? That's if you think that every advance for one group is a step back for another group. And that kind of thinking certainly happens around these questions of women in sports and women in education generally. It does happen that people think, oh, no, if women move forward, then men will be pulled down or pulled back. The evidence doesn't support that at all. I think there's much, much more evidence that women's participation and the participation of other minorities and underrepresented groups makes institutions stronger, more vibrant, increases opportunities for absolutely everybody. In the case of sports, it's certainly true that there are not any colleges or universities that field women's football teams. But I don't think that football is suffering because women are doing other sports. I think there's very, very little evidence of that.
One of the things that I've been wondering is if Title IX, as it relates to sports, has really changed the culture, because part of the issue was that there was this idea, not every woman felt this way, certainly, or every young girl, but there was less of a cultural acceptance of girls playing sports and fewer opportunities. But it was also partly, well, that's just not what girls do. You know, we're interested in other things, or sports isn't as big a part of our life. And so by creating this law and requiring schools to have opportunities for girls, I'm curious, Professor Kornbluh, if you think that it actually sort of tweaked the culture, because it not only created a space but actually created this this differing way that girls think about their participation in sports.
I think it did change the culture. And I think one thing to remember, I'm trained as a historian, so I think in sort of long terms, this is a very recent idea that girls or women wouldn't be interested in physical activity, organized physical activity. If you go back to the early years of the women's colleges in the late 19th, early 20th century, there was physical education. It wasn't football the way we understand it today, but women did all kinds of things in an organized way. So it was really a very recent and sort of strange idea that women didn't want to or need to be trained in that way. And I think it has changed the culture by having those opportunities available. It's not only what's happening in K-12 education and what's happening in colleges and universities, but it's also the broader world of spectatorship. We all see it. We all know that this is happening. And it also, when girls and women are trained in an athletic way in elementary school and high school, then they are in the pipeline and they can become Olympic level athletes. They can become professional athletes, and they start to apply pressure to expand women's opportunities, you know, throughout that athletic world. And I think it changes expectations, and it changes institutions as well. And I'll just put in one more thing, which is that, you know, we're talking about resources that are available for participation. We're also talking about scholarships, athletic scholarships that are available. It's a matter of educational equity. Who's going to be able to go to college, especially when, going to a four-year college or university is so expensive? And how can we deny that to the majority of the population?
Although, you know, it should be said that certainly the opportunities may be there in college and in high school, and there are a lot of amazing women Olympians, many of whom I have had the pleasure of being friends with, but that doesn't mean that we have equity in pay, even in professional sports for women, that, even the prizes when the sport is exactly the same in skiing or mountain biking or other arenas like that, we're still often seeing the purses for women much smaller than the purses for men, and the ability for sports to make money off spectators when it's a women's sport has also been an issue. So, you know, just because it's been equalized in educational opportunities doesn't necessarily mean that that has fully translated to the professional world. But Ethel emailed us to say, I think a broad change occurred in the quality of products made specifically for women because of Title IX. For instance, in my late 20s in 1971, I would buy a woman's bicycle with 3 gear speeds, you know, with that little step-through design that it was said was, quote, to keep our female anatomy intact. The bike for boys came with 10 gears, and it was better built. I could have 10 gears put on the girls' model bike for an extra $100. I bought and rode the boys' bike for 20 years, and Ethel says women's athletic shoes also changed and in general changed all of our shoes because it was recognized that women needed arch supports if they were going to run. So you do see these knock-on effects of products for women and other things that have come through because of Title IX. We're talking about Title IX today on its almost 45th anniversary. We're talking today with UVM's Felicia Kornbluh and visiting Dartmouth Professor Renee Berglund. And let's go to Jasdeep calling from Burlington. Hi, Jasdeep. Go right ahead.
Hey. Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
You know, just I was going to talk about something else, but, you know, I would say for the equality in pay, I would, you know, I don't know if the parties knew, but the Parliament in England, you know, had the same issue about Wimbledon because the women winner was not getting the same amount of money as the men's winner, but they actually had legislation that they equaled that out. That happened a few years ago, so at least across the Atlantic, they recognize that, so they actually took a step.
Well, and Jasdeep, happened in women's sports here. We've seen lawsuits now from professional women's sports associations saying, if you're going to pay the men, you have to pay us equal amounts. And, you know, some of the mountain bike racing that's happened in Vermont and ski racing has had equalized purses for women and men. So you see that coming up more and more. But go right ahead. You wanted to talk about something else.
Right, so I recall when this happened, and you know, I thought it was a little unfair if you were like on a team somewhere and you had to get cut because of this. But you know, now that the long term effect has kind of played out, it's obviously great. And also in the interim, I've also had a daughter. But you know what I have found that fascinating is that the government really put a lot of money into this, and rightfully so. But you know, I don't recall anything of this kind of backing by the federal government with the money wise. When it really comes to minorities and promoting and getting the equality that specifically, you know, African Americans have experienced for centuries because of, you know, just the slavery and not to mention segregation, you know, what would your position be on that? And why do you think that is that we haven't put that kind of money? We put it into different sexes, but not different races.
Jasdeep, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. Professor Berglund, what do you think? Have we? I mean, there are certainly laws that that relate to discrimination on the basis of race or ethnicity, but have we put the same kind of effort in this country?
Oh, I think the Civil Rights Act, we can't forget the Civil Rights Act. So Title IX comes afterwards and is a part of the Civil Rights Act, I'd say. But I think there are lots and lots of programs that try to address racism and discrimination in universities and in education, just as Title IX does for sex and gender. None of these programs have really completely worked. We haven't solved sexism. We haven't solved racism. But as we talk about it, there's so much positive effect from Title IX. Not just in the participation in varsity athletics, but also in the way that our attitude towards athletics has changed so that there are fantastic opportunities for dance classes and for fitness and for the sort of lifelong engagement with sports. And then beyond sports, of course, it's the same with other areas of education, just lots and lots of opportunities that have been created for women by Title IX and in terms of race and ethnicity by the Civil Rights Act.
I would just add that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is a big omnibus bill. So it actually covers educational institutions in its Title VI. Its Title VII has to do with employment, so it forbids discrimination on the basis of race in employment, but also on the basis of sex in employment. That's the only place where sex is mentioned in that 1964 Civil Rights Act. And what that title of that law did was it created the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So if you experience or you observe racial discrimination or sex discrimination in an employment situation, you should go to the EEOC, if not to some institution that's closer. And for these, for Title IX and also for Title VI of the 64 Civil Rights Act, it's the Department of Justice or the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Education. That should be your go-to. But there are public institutions which are not adequately supported and funded in either area that are supposed to be addressing this, and we need to make sure that they do.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess this is still the question, right, too, that equalizing opportunities is not necessarily just having a sports team available or having, having the ability to have equalized numbers of men and women or people of different ethnicities, because we're still talking about actual access to educational opportunity, which starts a lot earlier than the college years. You know, when it's one thing to get into a college, it's another thing to be able to go to a school that adequately prepares you to go to a college or that gets you accepted to that college. And educational opportunities, whether we're talking about for women or, as Jasdeep was bringing up, for people of different races and ethnicities, the law may say one thing. The way our culture has evolved to actually allow for access to opportunity is another thing that is not necessarily cured by a law like Title IX.
Well, what we say in legal history, for example, is that laws are not self-enforcing. We, the people, have to enforce them. We have to push, you know, and it's true. The liberal civil rights victories of the 60s and 70s are incomplete, and We can do more by demanding that they serve our needs and our community's needs and our colleagues and friends' needs.
Let's go to Charlotte calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Charlotte. Go right ahead.
Hi. Well, I just wanted to give you perspective of history, being an athlete coming up in the 60s and knowing that my coach had to really push for equal time in the gym, equal time on the field. We didn't have Title IX. I'm a high-functioning athlete even then, and there was no competition for me amongst the girls. They couldn't keep up with me because I had more opportunity. And then, you know, your Title IX provided opportunities for girls to really build their bodies and build their teamwork and build their self-esteem and get a scholarship to go to college. It's huge. It's wonderful to watch these young women outperform anything we could have thought of doing and change how they think about their bodies.
Charlotte, how do you think your life would have been different if Title IX had been around when you were looking at schools and you maybe could have gotten a scholarship or had more competitive sports opportunities?
That's a really interesting question because, again, I had opportunities others didn't have. I'm pretty sure I could have gotten a scholarship for college. I know I could have. I was the best athlete in the school, and you know, second to only one male. So I certainly would have had a scholarship, which could have made a difference in terms of my income later coming out. My parents had to scrape and save. It was not an issue. You know, it wasn't something they could do very easily to put me in college. So that would have been a big difference. And I would have had peers that could challenge me even more. It was too easy for me.
Well, I really appreciate your call and hearing about your experience. Thank you for sharing that. Let's get another call in from Peggy in Williston. Hi, Peggy. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi. What's your experience been?
I don't know where to start. It wasn't an athletic experience with me. I always wanted to be a veterinarian when I was a kid, and I got accepted to veterinary school at Ohio State. And at that time, in 1961, there were three veterinary colleges under court order to accept women. That was Iowa, Texas, and Colorado. My experience in vet college wasn't very pleasant. The dean at one time told me, well, we took you two girls to be in our class because we didn't want to have to go through the court system, so that's why you're here. All the while I was in vet school, I was working for a neurosurgeon. I was doing research because I'd had experience in research. And I had examined a racehorse and injured my back. I ruptured a disc. My doctor did surgery. And I was back in school in a week only to find out that I'd been kicked out. And at the end of my first year, Keith Sagatsky and I tied for first place in the class, which was also a mistake because once I wound up in that position, I was even more disliked for being smart. But anyway, back to the surgery. So I called my boss, an internationally renowned neurosurgeon, and I said, gee, I guess the vets over here, the dean over here, doesn't think too much of your surgery, because I said they kicked me out of vet school. Well, he went ballistic, and that afternoon the dean came back and apologized.
You know, Peggy, one of the things that your experience is bringing up here that's super interesting as we talk about Title IX and how it's been interpreted is that, you know, the law was designed to say you cannot discriminate on the basis of sex, or as we've interpreted it now, on the basis of gender. But that includes harassment. That idea of sexual harassment or harassment based on your gender, that is de facto discrimination because you're A, treating somebody differently, and B, making their opportunities fewer. And Professor Berglund, that's been one of the other big impacts of Title IX, is this idea that harassment is discrimination. Can you just very briefly speak to that?
Yeah, Peggy's experience is also about being a woman in science, and that's another area where Title IX has had a remarkable positive impact. What the evidence shows is that when institutions work at it, they can make science attractive to women and help women succeed in science, and they can also, as Peggy's experience shows, they can do exactly the opposite.
It's so interesting, so much to talk about. Certainly, we just scraped the surface today. Renee Berglund is a visiting professor of women, gender, and sexuality studies at Dartmouth College. Felicia Kornbluh is associate professor of history and gender, sexuality, and women's studies at UVM. She's also a member of the board of trustees of Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. Thanks so much to both of you for talking Title IX with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.